Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast with over 6.5 million unique listeners in more than 180 countries. I am your host, Brett King, back this week. I'm coming to you all the way from sunny Melbourne, Australia. Actually, it's sort of sunny. It's been very cold here. If you're in the US, it's in the 50s. If you're everywhere else in the world where we use Celsius, then it's been in the low teens. So it's a bit chilly, especially when I have my son at Luna Park, which is sort of the Coney Island of Melbourne. I've got to translate everything when I'm talking to our US audience because of metrics and versus imperial and these cultural differences. But anyway, it appears as if summer 2019 is officially over. We've had Labor Day weekend in the US, and of course, the Hurricane Dorian, a Category 5 hurricane that has made all sorts of chaos down in the Bahamas and the eastern coast of Florida. Winds of 200 miles per hour. That's crazy. The fall season is upon us, and that means conferences are kicking off. Breaking Banks is heading to Sibos in London later this month. Don't forget if you're going to Sibos, to hit us up, come by the Breaking Banks booth where we're going to be recording some shows there. And also Dave Birch and myself will be doing the closing keynote for the Inner Tribe sub-conference there, which Professor Brian Cox is doing the opening keynote of, which I'm extraordinarily excited to see. Big fan, geek out at all the astrophysicist stuff. And don't forget also to get your tickets to Finovate Fall, coming to New York City the same week, the week of the 23rd of September. And you can visit us on social media or on our website to find our promo code to save 20% on Finovate Fall. Now, let's get to the show. We've got some news that we will play in a moment. But on today's show, we're going to hear from Julie Albright, the author of Left to Their Own Devices: How Digital Natives Are Reshaping the American Dream, discussing how digital natives are hacking their own version of the American Dream, and how they use all this technology when you're native to this. And also joining us are Brian Romley and John Best of the Best Innovation Group, where we're going to get into the second half of the show talking digital culture, and joining us for a discussion on Voice First and a special announcement for the US space.
So just before we get to our guests for this week, we wanted to bring back our host and regular on the show, Jim Marus, because he's got an announcement for us. He's got some news for us hot off the press of what's going on in his neck of the woods. Jim, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here, Brett. Thanks a lot.
Now, you're joining the fold of podcast officially. You're having your own podcast setting up called Banking Transformed, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the whole idea of a podcast came out of some interviews I did at last year's Financial Brand Forum, and had a chance to interview Gary Vaynerchuk and
Gary V, yep.
Yeah, and some other really cool people, Jeffrey Haslett, who came out of Kodak, came out. Also, we had the ability to recently interview Hossein Ranama from Flybits. And what we felt was that I worked my team and said, you know what, maybe we can do a podcast that would not only be available on your typical listening media and platforms, but also gave a chance to create some really new content for the financial brand. So it's serving multiple purposes. I have to put a shout out to you, because if it wasn't for all the work that we've done together over the years on...
You've had a bit of experience with podcasts over the years.
Yes. just a wee bit, and now it's kind of funny because I was thinking this would be more of a casual effort, and immediately my son, who's a senior in university right now, said, "Dad, you got to build a cadence. You got to be going weekly. You got to make it so people know exactly where to find it, when to find it." I'm going like, "Oh my God, the teachers become the student. The students become the teacher." Because he's spitting back to me what I've been telling people about content marketing for years, but it's kind of.
Oh wow, yeah, the kids have an instinct for this stuff now that's insane because they live it every day, right?
Yeah, and what's interesting is it's going to be an interesting effort. I mean, I'm really focusing on the changes in the banking industry and how they're impacting things like leadership, culture. What are some of the key elements? It's staying in the wheelhouse of what we do with the financial brand and retail banking, but I'm hoping to take advantage of the opportunity I have because, you know, as you know, we're very fortunate in that we just know a whole lot of people that are deep in this industry, and I'm hoping to reach out to many of them and say, you know, I'd like to know your perspectives on things. We're not going to, you know, shake the world up with this, but I'm hoping that, you know, the way you work or something like this, the 22-minute podcast will be something that people want to listen to. We're going to be interviewing you next week, I think, and hoping to have you, you know, the podcast up with you pretty soon. And you know, coming up,
we're happy to support it. It's great, man. You know, anytime there's a bit of a spin-off from Breaking Banks like this, you know, it's good news. It shows that the content is still working, and the team that we've got is obviously, you know, the team that we've had involved in the podcast. If they go on to do stuff like this, it just shows the depth we've had across the team. It's phenomenal. So,
being able to leverage the Provoke Media brand and things that you're doing and the others on our team are doing, it rounds out the whole, you know, the realm of what we can do from a content standpoint, because Lord knows there's more than enough to go around as far as ideas and thoughts we have to be doing.
Well, that's great, man. Well, all the best with it, and I do look forward to being on the show on your podcast next week. And thanks for joining us this week to announce Banking Transformed.
Hey, glad to have you back in the U.S., Brett.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Take it easy. Bye bye.
Okay, so now let's get to our guests. We have joining us in the virtual studio today, Julie Albright. Now, Julie's the author, as I said, of this new book, Left to Their Own Devices. She's also a resident sociologist at USC. Julie Albright is actually calling us from there or joining us from there today. Julie, welcome to the Breaking Banks radio show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so how long have you been working out at USC and working on stuff like that? You're officially sort of a sociologist, right?
Yes, I have been working here since the early 2000s. Did my dissertation on online dating and how people were presenting themselves online. And after that, started doing some work with eHarmony, helped develop some of their product, and have just been looking at the emergence of social media and how that's really changing our behaviors and our society.
And when you start talking about sociology, how much is digital now sort of framing sort of social connections? I'm sure we're going to get into this in the book as well, but you know, like particularly just in terms of the dating stuff you're talking about, I saw a stat recently that like 4 in 10 couples now have met online. I don't know if that's an accurate stat.
Yeah, it's really reshaped everything. When I first started looking at that, people said, you know, what are you talking about? You know, they couldn't imagine people were actually meeting online. But now online dating is, I'm sure you're aware, has become a multi-billion dollar global industry. And it's either, depending on the study you look at and the age of the participants, the second or third most common way that people meet their spouses now. So it's really reshaping everything. It's really kind of incredible when you think about that.
Yeah, and probably 5 out of 10 marriages that end in divorce are probably due to Facebook as well.
That's true. Divorce attorneys actually said that they've seen a huge escalation in Facebook and things like that, where people are sort of rekindling old high school romances and things like that. You know, it's so easy to sort of fall into an affair that way, because you can be innocently chatting and then sparks start flying, and next thing you know, you're in a full-blown affair.
Great. Well, let's introduce two other of our regulars, and they can join the conversation. I think it'll be great. So we have Brian Romley, our Voice First expert, joining us again this week. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Brett. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining. And John Best from the Best Innovation Group. John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you guys feel free to jump into the conversation here, but let's get to the book, Julie. So your new book is called Left to Their Own Devices, How Digital Natives Are Reshaping the American Dream. Now, tell us the sort of inception of this book and what drove you to this. Because as a sociologist, obviously you're looking at all of the way technology has changed interactions between humans. But when did you get when was the epiphany in terms of, well, this is the book that I need to write?
Right. Well, I wrote a grant here at USC with the former CTO of Chevron, his name's Don Paul, and we wrote a $121 million smart grid grant, which had a behavioral piece, and it was the only behavioral piece in the country, so it was very innovative. And, you know, we started talking about this intersection of behavior and mobile devices and our infrastructure, our built environment. And, you know, as we got into the conversations, we started talking about the changes between people who were digital immigrants, in other words, those that came to the internet later, like baby boomers, and those that are digital natives that grew up in a world where there always was an internet. And as a sociologist, I also have two counseling degrees, by the way, so I'm sort of looking at the big social trends and then the impacts on the ground when you think about some of the behavioral and some of the mental health implications of what's going on. But the core concept is that young people, particularly millennials and young folks like that, that grew up in this world where there always was an internet, are coming what I call untethered. They're unhooking from traditional behaviors like getting married or buying a home or having children and going to church or joining a political party, and they're hyper-attached to digital technologies. So that's really changing the entire face of not only our social structures and world, but the economy and work and everything else.
You know, I have an interesting real-life example of that, which is we've been looking at kids that they don't want to go get their license. You know, yeah, it's like when I was 16, I ran straight to I might have been in the DMV overnight waiting for the next day. But then I have all these friends who their kids, they just aren't bothering to go get a car. And when I ask them why, and I coached wrestling at high school for a while, they said, oh, why do I need one? You know, Joe's got one over there. And they have this digital way of communicating with each other constantly that they can always get a ride or always get from some, you know, place A to place B. And so, what does that look like when you're running a bank where you sort of expect this, you know, third and fourth car loan at these milestones? So it's interesting, the sharing economy, but also how they've embraced that.
Well, you know, I remember when my daughter was, she was turning 16 or something, and we were talking about this in New York, and she's like, Dad, just give me an Uber account. That'll be fine.
That's amazing.
So, because, you know, in her mind, that it was going to be far better for her to be driven around so she could sit in the back and use her phone.
Well, yeah, that's it.
Around than than having to drive. But of course, I think autonomous vehicles are probably going to. This is why a lot of people who are sort of scratching their heads, thinking, "Oh, I'm never going to let a self-driving car drive me around." They forget how comfortable millennials and digital natives are going to be with this technology, because they're just going to see it as an extension of the sort of tech that they use every day.
That's right, and it also, when you think about this behavioral shift toward wanting to be connected all the time. Teenagers now say they are connected almost constantly. That's what they say. So this idea that you want to be connected almost constantly, driving gets in the way of that. So this idea of an autonomous vehicle allows young folks to stay connected and do the things they want to do. So like you said, you've got these generational value differences. Driving used to represent autonomy and socializing, like you said, as teenagers. Now they socialize online, so why do I need to drive over there? In fact, there was an interesting study done in Britain recently. They asked students, what'd you do over the summer? And they said, 65% of them said, well, I spent the summer by myself in my room. And yeah, what they're doing is they're gaming and they're on social media and texting and things like that. So these digital environments are somewhat taking the place of a lot of the analog activities of prior generations.
The physical socialization has turned to digital socialization.
That's right.
Now, if you talk to proponents like, and I know, Brian, you're going to definitely have some opinions on this, but if you talk to proponents of sort of the inevitability of the tech march, because a lot of parents will bemoan their children stuck on these devices all the time. They want them to get out and experience life. They want them to socialize physically with their friends. Have your friends over instead of playing with them digitally online when you're playing Fortnite or whatever. Get them to come to the house. When they're thinking about this, the reality is that we're sort of creating this new augmented human where we've augmented ourselves with these technologies, and so for these kids, it's very normal for them to socialize across the digital sphere, or maybe go and see a concert with, say, Hatsune Miku, the virtual pop star, performing or something like that. It doesn't occur to them that this should be exceptional behavior or different from the world their parents have grown up in. So maybe, Julie, as a sociologist, sort of explain the pressure on young people to be in this digital loop, for example.
Well, two things, I think, responding to what you're saying there. One is that the digital has almost, as we said, sort of taken the place of, in many cases, the face-to-face communication. And that's leaving a deficit of those sort of soft skills or communication skills. The dean of religious life here at USC, I did a panel with him, and he said every week now, I get a student coming up asking a question that they didn't ask 5 years ago. And that question is, how do I make friends? So this idea that, this analog face-to-face communication or even phone calls, there's a real deficit. They said when the iPhone came out, 90% of the time people used it to make phone calls and 10% was spent on apps. And now it's the reverse. Only 10% of the time is spent on phone calls and 90% is spent through these virtual communications on apps. So it's really, really reshaping everything.
So there is still some skills that, life skills that they need, basic life skills that they're just not getting from the digital sphere.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing is, I think that it's putting young people in a particular pressure that maybe baby boomers growing up without these devices didn't face. And that is living online, as it were, in places like Instagram, in these digital spaces. People, as you know, create these fantastical versions of themselves that are highly curated and photoshopped and tuned so their bodies and their faces and their atmospheres just look perfect. And young people compare their lives to those they see online, right, and can never measure up. The people that are posting those things don't even measure up. So it's really driving a lot of anxiety and depression and things for young people who haven't really got their self-identity pulled together yet or their coping skills. And they look to these people online, these influencers, and they think, gee, my life isn't that fantastic. So I think it's really setting up, I call this the virtual mirror. Instead of mirroring back like a reality they can compare to, it's like a funhouse mirror where it sort of warps reality and they're trying to compare themselves to that and will never measure up. So that's a problem for young people we have to address.
I to illustrate this point, what's really funny is that when you ask kids these days in the US what they want to be when they grow up, you know, there's a huge percentage of them that will say Instagram stars.
That's it.
And yet if you ask Chinese children the same question, you get astronaut. Because obviously the Chinese space program is burgeoning and you know, coming of age. And so it just sort of shows you, you know, how in the highly digital world. And, you know, China is pretty digital. I mean, they've got, they're huge live culture, live video culture and stuff like that. But I think influencers per se are less encouraged maybe by the culture there. I'm not sure what the differences are. But I did want to talk about, in the book, you do talk about, just sort of extending on this, you talk about some of the threats that are emerging as a result of this. So what do you see as the big threats from this increasing dependence and reliance on digital?
Right. Well, I guess just a few things. Putting on, again, my counseling hat, we have an escalation in recent years in terms of things like mental health disorders, anxieties, depressions. We have the highest rates in 30 years amongst college students. 25% of college students in the United States are on some kind of psychotropic medication for a mental disorder. So this idea that, you know, we need to bring back perhaps, or maybe re-swing the pendulum to get some balance in terms of maybe our physicality, in terms of going out in nature, some of these things that other generations did routinely that bring a sense of calm and peace, and, you know, they kick in the endorphins so that you boost your mood. And these things are sort of getting left behind in this race toward being always on, always connected. Because, frankly, these devices there is an aspect to them now that are addicting. They're designed to bring you back, wanting to connect again, want you to come back for more. Just like the one-armed bandits when you're trying to have a gambling addiction. Those same behavioral reinforcers are encoded into our apps now, like the Instagrams, etc. So it's very hard to sort of break away and create that balance, but we really need to do that. I think maybe parents can help also to create moments like maybe a family dinner at home without devices, for example, small ways, or go out for a hike, or you were talking about outdoors with your kids earlier. You know, these sorts of moments where you can spend time face-to-face without being mediated by a device.
Have you guys... Yeah, go, Brian.
You know, Brett, I've been studying this issue kind of fairly intently lately, especially in regards to why I believe ambient computing like voice first is going to be so weighing so prominently. You know, if you go back to the average person of, say, the 1500s, their information exposure is equivalent to about their entire life is equivalent to about 1 week of what the average person is dealing with today.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and so from an evolutionary standpoint, we have not developed the capacity to discern what all this means. And beyond that, we only have a 41 bit per second human bandwidth throughput of consciousness. And this is undisputed at this point. So that means we have a limit to all that we can take in on our conscious level. So subconsciously, we're absorbing basically 90% of this stuff. 99% is really more accurate. And what it's doing to us is exactly what Julie is saying. It's creating this depression and this information overload environment. And the problem is it's not high protein information. Let's call it junk food information. Most of social media is sharing, you know. And recently, I've been watching a lot of Marshall McLuhan videos. I posted them on my Twitter from 1967. And he talks about the medium, always uses the old medium as a context for the new medium.
Right.
And I think we're really caught in that right now, because this is a spanking new medium. It's less than 10 years old, what we would call the socialized internet. And I it doesn't look like it's heading to a good place with the addictions that are taking taking a toll on primarily young folks, but it's permeated older folks too. The highest cohort of growth on Facebook is senior citizens, and their addiction level is climbing. So it's an interesting thing about the human brain. How much information can we handle? And implanting that information in our brain is not necessarily going to make it easier, because consciousness is consciousness. You can't increase that bandwidth.
And my favorite Marshall McLuhan quote is, "I don't know who discovered water, but it probably wasn't a fish." It's a great way to describe sort of how we become sort of immune or unaware of a lot of the elements of our environment, you know. Brian, I know.
I was going to ask a question. I was going to follow up over Brian, so I wanted to ask Julie a question. So, Julie, I was listening or reading to Malcolm Gladwell, and he was talking about how many relationships we can really support. And I think this goes back to what Brian was saying, that we all grew up, you know, originally man was in these villages where there was maximum 150 people. And looking at my kids, and Brett, maybe you see this too, I feel like one of the stresses that they feel is trying to maintain, like, you know, you talked about parents wanting gamers to come to the house. Well, some of those gamers may not be anywhere near in their geographic vicinity, and they're maintaining so many relationships. That seems like that would be stressful to
me. They might not even be in the same age cohort. I mean, a lot of these folks have an online persona that is not who they are in the real world, and that's troublesome.
Yeah, and then the second follow-up question to that is, this is something I discovered. You know, I once sent my daughter to the store to get lemon juice, and you know, that's kind of hard to find, right? Is it with the lemons, or is it, you know, somewhere else with the condiments? She came back and told me they didn't have any. I know darn well that Safeway has lemon juice, so I asked her, did you ask anybody? And she said, no, but I looked it up online, and they said they didn't have it. And I said, well, why didn't you ask them one? And our common theory is that they don't want to talk to people because they've been so closed off. But actually, what I figured out was, because of something she said to me, she said, well, those people are working. I don't want to bug them. And so in her mind, like, this is the first place you go for information. And then bothering people is not like even on the table, because the company should have its act together and lemon juice should have been described of where it should be for her to get to.
No, I remember having to replace a car battery and doing other things like that, like, you know, setting a fire out in the fire pit in the backyard and saying to my son, you know, the age of 13 or so, come and help me. It's a life skill. You can learn this life skill. And he'd say, Dad, if I need to know, I'll just watch a YouTube video.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's the solution, you know, and it's like, so he didn't even want to learn that life skill from me. But if I ever need it, Dad, I've got YouTube. I can go there and check it out. So definitely a cultural shift. Well, I'm conscious of the time.
Not just one video, but 23,000 videos,
And
in every language, and if you want like a chimp to teach you or sock puppets, that's an option as well. So it's not just... It's not just the information that's out there, but the amount of it and the way it's delivered that they look for, that they're finding their own models of learning behaviors.
So before we go to break, Julie, one of the things that I'm very interested in is two pieces of technology we're obviously looking at coming down the pipe here. One is spatial computing, so smart glasses and this sort of tech that we'll be wearing and integrated further into our body. But the second is one where this could really skew relationships, which is how we'll have a personal AI and how we might even develop a close connection with that personal AI. And I know Brian's going to have comments on this because he's working on this tech as we speak. Uh-huh. But you know, how do you think that could skew things when you have a personalized version of Alexa or Siri that's your constant companion digitally, that, you know, not only answers all your questions but actually can sort of mold itself around your behavior?
Right. Well, first of all, in terms of wearing things on your face, I'm not a big fan, because it interrupts the long-evolved nonverbal communications between people. When I saw the Google Glass come out, I told Robert Scoble, that's not going to work. And he said, keep saying that, Julie. I said, I will keep saying that. So I'm saying it again.
Yeah. He's a believer.
Yeah, it's a no. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But the second piece is more troubling in a way and very interesting, the idea of these AIs. And I guess it sort of encourages a certain kind of narcissism. And what I worry about is as things become more and more tailored and pushed to you, to what you like, based on what you already know and your preferences and your activities, is it going to set us up in a world where maybe you don't discover as many new things or try certain things because you're getting fed by these AIs more of the same.
Your existing preferences.
Right. So that's my concern about that, is that we're getting more and more isolated as a culture in a way because we're in these information bubbles, and that's already happening on social media. And I think that's going to amplify when we talk about these smart technologies that'll be interacting with us as AI agents.
Mm, very interesting. Brian, we've talked about the instinctive nature of these technologies and how in the future you won't even have to talk to them because you just sub-vocalize, your thoughts and so forth for these technologies. But, how do you think it's going to change day-to-day communication between humans?
Well, I agree with Julie quite a bit. We are in informational bubbles and we currently are doing our own editing. We're doing our own self-selecting. But it is also being done for us by the informational systems that we are using.
By the Russians, you mean?
Yeah, the Russians or the Chinese, whoever you want to believe. So, the systems that I build have serendipity engines built in, and this is vitally important. I live by serendipity. So I think that you can do this, but you have to build it from that premise to begin with. And I can't say that any of the voice first platforms today are built on that. They're designed by engineers to give you what they believe are the facts that you're looking for. And humans really aren't looking for facts. They're looking for a best guesstimate or an idea. Like, for example, if you want to know what the traffic is like, you don't want to know exactly how many seconds and how many miles and how many car crashes. You want to know if you're going to get to your appointment on time. And the same thing is about the news. The thing, and again, I can go to Marshall McLuhan again. He said with the invention of satellite TV, you're no longer having somebody interpret the news for you in words. You'll see it in real life. Now, the question is that actually news? And are you now discerning yourself? And the next question to that is, are we teaching discerning beyond just personal assistance skills? And I think a top priority in education is to create discerning skills along with creativity. Those are the two things that are vitally important. And it's not necessarily understanding logic or even STEM. So understand the discernment of how humans have coalesced information and how they shape narratives, why there are allegorical stories and why there are reasons that you transmit different stories on different levels for different people at different times. But with the personal assistant, I am not dystopian about it. I really don't believe in this concept that you're going to be making something that you want to fall in love with. I think what you're going to be making is a colleague.
A complementary consciousness, yeah.
Exactly, and I call it intelligence amplification rather than AI. So I reverse the AI into the IA. And I really believe that that's the future direction of humanity. Now, there's going to be a lot of bumps along the way. I believe that we'll right ourselves.
All right, well, Julie, conscious of the time, we've got to go to a break. But before we do that, tell us how we can get more information on the book and where you're next going to be out and about speaking about your book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been such a wonderful conversation. If you want to learn more about the book, it's at www.devicesbook.com. I'm still on the world tour going
That's
to Singapore.
That's a great URL.
Thank you. Singapore, then I'll be in Austin, a brief jaunt through New York, Akron, Ohio, so there'll be quite a few more events coming up. So look forward to seeing you guys out on the road somewhere.
Absolutely, and you've had obviously some great opportunities already to get out there in the south of France and stuff. So pretty cool. All right, well, yeah. Julie Albright, thanks for joining us, and enjoy the rest of the day out at USC.
Thank you so much, Brett, and thanks, guys, for the great conversation.
All right, guys, let's just go to a quick break, and we'll be back after the break. You're listening to Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Before the break, we were talking with Julie Albright about her book, Left to Their Own Devices. We've still got on the show Brian Romley and John Best. And John's team has been working on a new Voice First initiative, hence why we've got Brian on. He's sort of the world's expert on this technology. But we'll be talking about, over the last few years in the show, in terms of artificial intelligence and personification of that through voice, but the big thing is, how are institutions going to adapt to this technology? And so, John, tell us a bit about the initiative you're working on with Big Consulting in terms of helping banks and credit unions stake their claim in the voice first world.
Sure. So we started off when we first started this, we actually couldn't even get Amazon to help us, get the first couple cranes out. But we were very fortunate in being introduced to some great people over at Amazon and quickly found our way in. But we understand that, to your point, the medium size and the smaller institutions are struggling sort of to find their way into this voice world. So one of the things we realized right off as we were expanding into Google Home is that Google Home, which it uses something called Actions, which you can equate to skills on the Amazon side, they are sort of the apps of that world, and Google Home will not let you have a duplicate name. So there can only ever be one Suncoast Credit Union.
The domain names, right?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly like it. And so we realized, earlier this year that, hey, there are a lot of credit unions out there that have similar names for one thing, and there are a lot of banks who also have similar things. How many first communities are there? And so what we've devised is a website where you could simply sign up, and it's depending on your asset size, it could be anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000 or $3,000, and basically get what I call a voice website set up very quickly. So the voice website would just basically have your phone numbers, your routing numbers, all that classic information, but no account information. But what it does is it allows you to grab that invocation name, which, if you've ever used Alexa, you would, say, open this skill. For example, when we work with our home banking skills for the credit unions, it would be, Alexa, ask Suncoast what my balance is. And if you don't tell it which balance, she'll ask. And then with Google, it's almost the same thing, except for sometimes it's a different verb, it's tell. But either way, you've got to get that name. And so we wanted to work and make an easy way for people to get something out there very quickly. So we built a integration engine that will put it out for both. You just fill it out, you put in some information, you make your payment, and the next thing it's going to automatically upload all that to our team. And then as you know, we're going to automatically submit it. And as soon as they approve it, you'll be out there with a voice website.
Fantastic. You know, it sort of strikes me as ironic. Every time we go through these new phases of these new technologies, I remember being on the road trying to convince people to get a website in 95 when I owned my first ISP, right? And, you know, I'd go to these businesses in Australia, because I was still based in Australia back then, and I'd be telling them about, you know, we had this setup where they could build their own website, very easy, a browser-based tool. They could just plug in their details and it would populate a website automatically for them. It enable them to get their own domain name. And all these people were like, nah, I think I'm okay, mate. I'll just put another ad in the Yellow Pages, you know. And And so, you know, like obviously, you know, 5-6 years after that, you know, we saw this flood of people trying to get domains and trying to get access. And I don't understand why people aren't more defensive in this respect, doing exactly what you're suggesting, you know, staking a claim, getting that position there. Who knows if you're going to use it in the future or not, if it's going to be a big part of your business, but shouldn't you mitigate the risk of being pushed out of this? Because, you know, how many Sun Trusts are there, or, you know, around the world that have names similar to that, you know, some in banking, some not, that will need to own that name on the voice OS, right?
Yeah. And Brian, you know, how many, I think at this point, I was looking at VoiceBot AI the other day. I was, you know, talking to Brett, and I think we've got what, close to almost, what was it, 150 billion devices, or probably 36 billion devices by 2020. Which is,
I think that's a conservative estimate, actually. You know, and if you take China and India, which is growing faster than the United States, it's expanding faster than any other technology adoption in history. And it's hard for people to get their mind around this. This is so much faster adoption than a smartphone, than the web browser, or anything else. You know, I'm not saying that this is a technology that we're going to have forever. It's going to morph into the way the original cell phone morphed into the iPhone, which morphed into the app engine that we see it is today. But what you're doing, John, is brilliant. And, you know, it also belies a tremendous problem. The longer your name, the more complex these invocations become.
Yeah.
So if you were a federal credit, you know, union of whatever, you now have this really long invocation.
Navy Federal Credit Union. That's a short one.
Yeah, but the thing is, there's probably, and again, I'm not an expert on naming, but I did work in this industry. I'm sure there's probably a few hundred that Federal Credit is probably the first part of their name. So now the next question is, what is Amazon and Google going to do when they reach the limit? And that limit is what happened with the internet number naming authority is that we started going from .com to .net to .xyz, literally. There are so many naming conventions now. You know, obviously the .com is more highly coveted. So
dot
was
radio,
the
.fm, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, domain names become less important when you have silos that shunt your information to those silos. That would be the app in this current epoch. But in the future epoch, the conversation is going to be the domain and the intent. So what that really means is, and it might be hard for folks to get their mind around this, is that you're not going to invocate anything. You're going to create a highly contextual relationship with a grouping of words or a concept. So when you say, Alfred, I'd like to hear details about my bank balance, Alfred doesn't care what the bank is. It already knows. So you don't need to say bank name. You don't need to say any of these things. And that's where it's moving to. Now, once
that's,
you start...
a sort of a behavioral approach to this, because he's learned which bank is yours. So, but the first few times, you still have to identify the bank. Or
Of course. So between now and that 10-year span where we are now, if you don't secure your invocation name, and John's doing an incredible job in doing this. If you don't do that and you're in a financial organization, you're absolutely insane. In fact, I would say that it is probably a breakage of fiduciary responsibility at some point, because you could lose a tremendous amount of assets to that to your customers, at least from my point of view. And then as we move to highly contextual, it becomes something else, and that's even more cerebral that the these executives are going to have to get their mind around.
Well, and to your point, a lot of these credit unions use acronyms. So, and yeah, they're very commonly called by those acronyms, which, by the way, as you and I both know, are difficult to do in invocation names, because you can't always do SSML. So somebody could spell it out. So there's a lot to think about on how that changes. I do appreciate, I'm actually going to have to write that down and put it on the front of the website. Fiduciary, what did you say? That they
the failure of fiduciary responsibility. You know, just like Brett, I used to sell websites too in the 90s, along with merchant accounts. And I would give a little lecture to executive staff about their fiduciary responsibility to protect their brand. And, once domain names started to become very hot commodities, we started registering thousands of domains on behalf of our clients and gave it to them, literally. I mean, we had some clients that said, I don't care. And I'm like, okay, let's just go and do it. It was free for a very small period of time, and then it started getting costly, and it saved their fiduciary responsibility. Put it that way. Others didn't want it, and it really hurt them. I can't name the company, but they lost a highly prized domain because they were just sleeping at the wheel.
I got a similar story to tell, Brian. We were working with a major tourist authority, mm-hmm. and they let their domain lapse. They owed us $1 million in unpaid fees for work that we'd done. And so we waited for the domain to lapse. We then registered it ourselves and sold it back to them for what they owed us.
Did you put up a website that said you could have this back if you put
No, we didn't do that. We just we kept it running because we were hosting it for them as well. And we just said, we wanted to talk with you guys about a deal on the ownership of the domain. They're like, what are you talking about?
A low-key carrot and stick approach. I love it.
When I, to your point, Brian, when I was working at Suncoast, I had my first job there in 95, I bought, because I was actually part of the Florida Educational Resources Network. So I was a teacher before I worked at Suncoast. That's how I got there. It was Suncoast FCU, and I went out and bought it for them. It wasn't too super expensive. It was like $20 at the time. So it just gotten to where you had to pay a little bit to register with the ICANN or whatever. And I tried to turn it in as an expense, and they said, no. And I said, but you need this. And they said, no. And I said, no, I'm serious. I didn't make this up. This is actually an expense. And I showed it to them, and they just, matter of fact, I think I owned it and it was under me for, the first 2 years. And finally I got them to build a website, but that's neither here nor there. But the point is that they weren't even set up to go through accounting to pay for something like this. Like, the idea of paying for this digital fungible asset was just out of their mind. Like, I might as well have said, hey, I bought this, digital magic card, and can you guys pay for it? I mean, it just was, they couldn't understand.
You're right.
And I think we're at that point with voice now.
Yeah. And just for a resource capability, I mean, the fact that there are so many of these devices, and you're in the kitchen, you're in the car, because automobile is the next frontier here, and you want to find out what is the closest location. Well, we have GPS information in the automobile and in the Amazon version of the car, Alexa, where it can say it can start routing you right to that location. And obviously Siri and Google are going to do that and are doing that. So it's vitally important to build, like the first websites that probably Brett and I did, they were basically business cards, postcards, they were the very rudimentary bits of information about the business until they develop the strategy, until they develop the infrastructure and the back end and the security. Personally, I think you should be doing all those things if you're a top tier bank. If you aren't doing it right now, you're already way late to the game. That you will see a lot more. I also think you need to develop your own persona. If you're a top 500 bank and you don't have a voice that represents your logo, you're about 3 years behind.
I was going to say that, obviously you've created your own voice-based personal assistants, Brian. So you've got Alfred, and you've got, what's your new one, the female persona? Esther.
Agatha.
That's right. Now, so how long before we see, you know, corporations creating their own persona, or is it, do you think it's just going to be more personalized down to the human?
I think both, and I think it's vitally important. First off, it's sort of like using the generic font of the original Netscape browser and the generic white or gray background. I mean, that's where we are right now. You don't want to use the default voice of the system to communicate. How much trillions of dollars are invested in the image and brand ID and logo of a business, and then you're going to have the default voice communicate with your customer? That customer becomes an extension to the, or sorry, that voice becomes an extension to the business, to the customer. And there needs to be a tremendous amount of thought put into this, much more than the visual arts. When you create a persona, you need to go into the details beyond what you would normally see in Hollywood.
Create a digital personality.
Exactly. And,
well,
and
it's colloquialisms from the area, right? And all kinds of things.
Well, yeah. And again, I'm in Southern California. I started doing this about 10 years ago, and they thought we were insane. We would storyboard this just like we would a character for a movie. And there's actually even more to it. We have a proprietary way that we do this. And you can't just throw your hands up, pick some generic voice and say that kind of sounds good. If you don't do the psychological research and the demographic research, it's sort of like using just a generic font for your logo or a generic color for your logo. And so when I sit down with these major brands most of the summer, I kind of had to stop. I did 10 major corporations. I sat down and talked to them about their persona. And I had, you know, C-level people sitting there and saying, nobody in our business is telling us this. You're the first organization that's come in here we're way behind. And I go, yeah, you know. And so we roll up our sleeves right there and we start building persona. I go, let's do it. You got a blackboard. Who is the voice of this company? And what's the tone? What's the tonality? Because we also do other sonic landscapes. Every business should have a tone associated with it also. But
we,
that's
we created a special tone.
I was going to say, CU Voice Registry actually has the ability for an add-on, and we have a big pile of tone. As you know, I'm a musician. I think you know that too, Brad. So is most of my team. So we built all these tones. You know, you think about NBC, if I go boom, 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 everybody knows.
Or the Intel tone. The Intel tone is,
yep.
Yeah, it's
the Apple startup, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think was Trevor Rabin, right? I can't remember. But, or was that Microsoft? But either way, the idea that you need, I was going to say, I can't quite build you a persona yet, but we're headed that way. And actually, funny that you have Alfred and Agatha. I have to introduce them to Winston, which is the one I've been working on for a while. It's named after my dad's cigarettes, but it also kind of sounded like a butler name. Heavy at the birthing seat. He's got a bad TPOD thing. He just coughs a lot. But you know, it's one of those things that I agree with you. You have to look in the psychology of that and decide. And again, it's regional. It's based, which, by the way, Brian, maybe you agree with me on this, but there's two points to that. One, I was going to ask you, you know, at this point, if I go to Alexa and I say, hey, Alexa, tell me about, you know, or open, you know, and I give them my bank name or my financial institution name, and it's not there, it just says I can't help you with that. How much of a degradation do you think that is before they'll come back? And was it similar to the internet? And is it worse now? I guess that'd be one question.
Well, I know, John, this conversation could go on for another hour, I'm sure, but we are running out of time, unfortunately. We've only got a couple of minutes left, so I think if we get into another couple of questions, we're gonna definitely run out of time. But so just before we go, first of all, Brian, can you give us an update on the work you're doing on the Voice First stuff with Alfred and Agatha, particularly the intelligence augmentation push? And then, John, just tell us how we can find out more information about your initiative.
Thank you for that. I'm just working along in my garage. What I'm really doing, you know, for the last 15 years, my context has been encoded into these systems. And they're what I call hyperlocal and hypercontextual. And by hyperlocal is none of my intelligence amplifiers ever touch the internet, ever. It doesn't even go to the internet. They go through intelligent agents that only come back with information in an encrypted form in an encrypted envelope. That's vitally important, and it's something that's we're all going to be facing is, do we want, the more context we get, do we want more and more of that in the cloud? And my answer to that is probably not. I'm working on that. I'm working on creating longer and longer dialogues. We're in Q&A mode with these current systems, which is really like the text-based CPM systems that we had in the very early days of the personal computer. When we get the full color treatment of voice first, it's conversations. It's truly interactive, contextual conversations. Now, I'm not going to try to fool you in the Turing test that this is a human being, but at some point, you're not going to care because the conversations will be rewarding. And so that's kind of my biggest push. I am writing books about this, but I'm also kind of taking time off to actually build it. So I'm a conflicted individual. Do I write or do I build, or do I build and do I write?
I get that. I completely get that, obviously. But, you know, there's a really interesting conversation between Jack Ma and Elon Musk from an event last week on this stuff, which I thought was really useful. But, Brian, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Stay tuned, obviously. We'd love to hear from Alfred at some point on the show. John, where can we find out more about the Voice First Initiative?
Yeah, so starting with credit unions, you go to CU, Voice Registry. That's all run together, the letter C, the letter U, voiceregistry.com. And you can actually put your institution's name in there. It'll ask you for it. It'll do a search. We actually found a way to track all the different financial institutions that are on both Google Home and Amazon. And off you go. So you just hit that site, and all the information is right there, CUvoiceregistry.com.
Fantastic. Well, John Best from Big Consulting Group, and Brian Romley, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for the show this week, folks. Don't forget, we've got over 300 episodes in the can with guests such as Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Boris Johnson, before he was Prime Minister, that is, on the show in our back catalogue. Check them out. And if you get a chance, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is you listen to the show. Give us a shout on social media. Tell us what you want to hear from us next. And most of all, keep listening and keep talking about Breaking Banks. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you guys again next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.